The youth advisory board that we've been engaging with has provided an enormous amount of support. They've offered us the opportunity to really learn from their experiences, but also really shaped, you know, the next steps of my research. Because, you know, through their analysis and interpretation, we've, of course, as researchers, interpreted some of the data, but having them interpret it separately and bringing those two ideas together have really enlightened us in ways that we could not have imagined previously.
Welcome to the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing podcast, Aging Fast and Slow. This podcast is supported by the National Institute on Aging Pioneer Award. Thanks for listening. We are Dr. Sarah Zanton
and Dr. Deidre Cruz, your hosts. For the past several seasons, we have been exploring the dynamics of structural racism. In this season, we shift our focus to the extraordinary power of structural resilience. We will talk with scientists, thought leaders, and innovators about the importance of resilience that extends beyond the individual level to include communities and policies. To enlighten us on this topic, we welcome Dr. Kamala Alexander, Associate Professor and Associate Director of the PhD and Postdoctoral Programs at the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing. Much of Dr. Alexander's work examines the socio-structural determinants of trauma and violence on sexual, mental, and reproductive health outcomes among marginalized young people. Her research deepens our understanding of the intricate interplay between social structures and resilience and provides invaluable insights into developing strategies that fortify communities in the face of these challenges.
Welcome. From your research, what role does the focus on structural and internalized stigma play in influencing the effectiveness of interventions aimed at improving health outcomes among people simultaneously experiencing or at risk for HIV and intimate partner violence?
Well, I'm really excited to be here with you, both of you. It's just really a joy. And I'd like to just start off by saying that orienting everyone to an understanding that HIV is a virus and that attacks the body's immune system. And if it's not treated, it can lead to AIDS. And intimate partner violence is a constellation of behaviors by a current or former partner that can cause physical, sexual, or psychological harm to another person. Now, both of these conditions are, you know, often really understood in an individual or an interpersonal way. However, what we know about them is they often are co-located within communities and affect certain communities more than others. For example, we know that Black Americans who have been disproportionately marginalized into particular neighborhoods and particular zip codes tend to have higher rates of experiences with both HIV and intimate partner violence. And so what I'm interested in is understanding how structural stigma as well as internalized stigma really kind of play out at all of those levels, whether it's at the individual, the interpersonal, or at the structural level. And so when we think about stigma, it really shows up in a lot of different ways in relationship to both of these conditions. So intimate partner violence has a certain set of stigmas that people experience. For example, they may not want to seek help if they're experiencing it within their home from a neighbor because it's often kept secret. And families don't want to talk about being harmed within their own households. So by experiencing that stigma, they are less likely to seek help when they're experiencing harm. HIV, on the other hand, when a person is first diagnosed with HIV, they may not want to tell their family members. Mm-hmm. And if they can't tell or seek that support from within their families, then they're less likely to go get treatment on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. Because HIV is a lifelong condition, but can be treated, it's really important that the stigmas that people experience within communities do not become barriers to their ongoing engagement in care. And that care is not only housed within the healthcare environment. So when we think about structural resilience, we need to make sure that the institutions that people are interacting with on a daily basis do not become a barrier to them being able to disclose that they are having these experiences. In other words, if stigma is pervasive throughout those institutions, it keeps individuals and it keeps families outside of the systems that have been put in place to support them on a daily basis.
And it sounds like you're also saying that these stigmas work against each other, where the stigma of intimate partner violence might mean that you don't want to tell people outside of the family, and the stigma of HIV might mean you don't want to tell people inside the family, and so you're kind of alone with having both.
Correct. Yeah, and I think that you're bringing up a really good point, because one of the things that I often hear from participants that have been in my studies is that isolation and loneliness mm-hmm. is one of the biggest reasons that they are not in a good place mentally, or that they want to come together with other people mm-hmm. that are having similar mm-hmm. experiences. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that brings me to the crux of my research is building within institutions and within spaces this interconnectedness that mm-hmm. people are often seeking. And if they're experiencing intimate partner violence or at risk for HIV or living with HIV, the fabric of those connections is often disrupted, and they're looking for places in order to be with people that are having similar experiences in order to problem solve, in order to have support. And our current institutions are just simply not set up to facilitate those kind of connections.
Mm-hmm. Right. Wow. So one of the things that I really appreciate about your work is while you certainly are working in a space where the population that you're looking to support is certainly facing a lot of barriers, a lot of your work really focuses on kind of bolstering the strengths that they have. And I was wondering if you could share with us what your thoughts are about the need to develop more sort of strength-based interventions that focus on these specific populations, including people with HIV, men, transgender individuals, and Black women in the U.S.?
I really think of intimate partner violence as a driver of the social determinants of health that we are so familiar with. Mm-hmm. So as an example, we are currently working with a group of Black women living with HIV and interested in understanding and developing interventions to make sure that women are staying engaged in their HIV care, as well as developing strategies for safety when they're experiencing intimate partner violence. And I'll tell you that when we, you know, first developed the idea, that those were like our two main goals. You know, we want people to be going to see their healthcare provider, getting their medications, and those really important things that keep the physical body healthy. However, what we're finding is that many of the women who are coming into the study are expressing lifelong battles of being beaten down, not only physically by a partner, but also just by the systems that we have in place to help them. Hmm. And if we think at a surface level about the social determinants of health and housing, for example, many of our markers of success are that a person has been given a Section 8 voucher or that they have a place to live. But the nuance is that if the place that they have access to is not inhabitable, not comfortable, not a place that they want to bring up their child, then we really haven't reached success. Mm-hmm. But the system says that we have successfully housed that person. Mm-hmm. And so yeah. I think what is really important is that we examine the systems and how they're actually working for the people that are in them, rather than looking at these very discrete data points that are not providing us with any kind of qualitative understanding mm-hmm. of what that experience mm-hmm. is. And so one of the, some of the things that we're kind of building into this intervention are, you know, real life examples of how you actually pick up the phone, who answers it, and what are the questions that you're actually needing to ask in order to get what you need. There's just not enough guidance on how people can advocate for themselves in order to develop an understanding of how the system can work for them. I think that it's all there and well-intentioned. However, people are showing up at the doors, and even though the door might open when they get into the system, they don't know which direction to go. And so that's just been one of the like kind of really eye-opening experiences that I'm hearing. And so the strength is in bringing these women together and them on their own sharing all each of their different ways that they're navigating the system. So they might be entering the same system that is meant to provide housing, but they each have very different experiences in getting what they actually need.
Yeah.
And so they're able to share that information amongst themselves, but there's a level of having to figure it out that really, for someone that is, you know, facing barrier after barrier after barrier, if they can't get that right, then they're not going to take their medicines. They're not going to come to their doctor's appointment. And so I think, you know, just kind of figuring out the best ways to develop new measures of success and building on the strengths that all of these women that have been in these systems for so many years have, we're not really accessing that. And so I think that would be my idea of a strengths-based intervention.
It reminds me of Laura Samuel's work with sharing vignettes about financial strain, like not having enough money, and then the group kind of problem solving how they would, you know, help this person, and it ended up being a little bit of an intervention, like people learning from each other, oh, you could do this, and you could, when she really was just trying to get their thoughts on this vignette, but it turned out that to be a little bit of an intervention. Mm-hmm. So switching to another kind of systems-based area, you work a lot about reproductive autonomy, which is important. And I think post-Dobbs decision, people thinking a lot more about reproductive autonomy than they were. You talk about reproductive autonomy in the face of women facing reproductive coercion and intimate partner violence. And have you thought about how structural resilience perspective can be used with healthcare systems or social systems to ensure greater access for contraceptive methods that are not dependent on a partner being willing to use them?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's really important to define what reproductive coercion is first. So reproductive coercion is usually in the context of an interpersonal relationship when one partner is disrupting the ability of another partner to decide when they want to become pregnant, if they maintain that pregnancy through interference with contraceptive methods, with interference with access to abortion, with interference with going to healthcare appointments. So in the context of an interpersonal relationship, we see that, you know, it's a tactic and often co-occurs with intimate partner violence and includes a number of different behaviors. I would say that, you know, post-Dobbs, we are in many places in the United States and our country, experiencing effectively state-sponsored reproductive coercion because the government is acting, has power over the autonomy of individual and family decision-making about reproduction. And in that case, we also have to think about historically that Black women have been coerced within the system to be sterilized without their permission, kept from certain contraceptive methods. And so what we've found in some of the studies that I've done is that long-acting contraception is a type of contraception that is undetectable by a partner who's wielding abuse or violence against another partner. And so often, advocates and healthcare providers are interested in providing that option to people who are experiencing those behaviors in their relationship. Hmm.
So how can structural resilience be incorporated, in your view, into different community level strategies to try to address this issue of reproductive coercion, and maybe particularly considering some of the unique challenges that young Black men might face and the different social norms and things that are influencing the situations there? Just curious about your thoughts.
Mm-hmm. So I've done a couple of research studies with young Black men in an effort to understand what is actually going on in relationships where there are perceptions of reproductive coercion that are occurring, particularly because that phenomenon has mostly been studied from the perspective of women. And we know that in many communities, people desire to have children and develop legacies for their families. Mm-hmm. And in Black communities in particular, we found that young Black men who were facing enormous challenges at a neighborhood level where violence is persistent, where they were experiencing the consequences of policies that have kept families from reaching their full economic potential, that creating a legacy and bonding with a partner, escaping and correcting past experiences with violence, in addition to a lack of comprehensive sexual education and understanding how healthy relationships are built, that creates an environment where many behaviors that are meant to show love or are derived from a need for power and control of their own lives show up as coercive behaviors towards their partners. Hmm. And so that was a really interesting finding that, you know, many of them talked about wanting to be more intimate with their partner by having a child together. Mm-hmm. And from the woman's perspective, they may have felt coerced into having a child when they didn't really want one. And so that study really opened up an opportunity to think about, first of all, how we measure this phenomenon and unanimously kind of call it violence, and the need to contextualize what's actually happening in those relationships, and that those relationships are born out of cultural expectations that are coming from communities as well as structures that many of the people that are involved in the relationships have no control over, and that are just part of familial and community legacies that are inner consequences of policies that they have no control over.
Right. Yeah. So in your research, Dr. Alexander, you often or always use community advisory boards, and listeners may not know what those are, but essentially you get advice from people who are in the population that you are working with to understand. And I think that's particularly interesting with you working with young people and adolescents, that I think a lot of listeners might think that we know everything as adults and we don't need to get advice from adolescents. But your work with your community advisory boards has been so powerful. And I wondered if you could tell the listeners a little bit about how and whether they've been valuable and any lessons that you've learned in particular from working with adolescents on your boards.
Yeah, of course. I really treasure the time that we spend together with our youth advisory board. The youth advisory board that we've been engaging with has provided an enormous amount of support. And we've really engaged them in a very different way. We have offered them, or they've offered us, the opportunity to really learn from their experiences, but also the Youth Advisory Board has provided assistance with analyzing our data, with developing and reframing our research questions, the ways that we develop our surveys. We've also been really excited to offer opportunities for their learning and providing educational enhancements that they take back to their communities. some of our youth advisory board members have created Instagram posts where they've talked about the things that they've learned on the youth advisory board, as well as advice that they would give to other youth. And so that's been a, you know, really rewarding experience. And it's really shown us how to keep people engaged in a topic that they're very interested in. They've also really shaped, you know, the next steps of my research, because, you know, through their analysis and interpretation, we've, of course, as researchers, interpreted some of the data, but having them interpret it separately and bringing those two ideas together have really enlightened us in ways that we could not have imagined previously.
That's wonderful. And for people not in the studio, Kamala's face just lit up when I asked her.
Oh, yeah, it sure did. Yeah, so Kamala, we are so fortunate to have you leading the PhD and postdoctoral programs at our School of Nursing. And just curious, as far as given your work in addressing structural resilience, what do you feel like the next group of researchers needs to learn or needs to know about as they're sort of developing their own careers that we're hoping many more will be working in this area?
Well, I definitely feel like students are coming to our program that are more aware of how individuals and families are situated within the structures that we've built. And so that has been a nice, refreshing way to understand and build an educational environment. I would definitely advise our next generation to stay focused on their passions. We often are asking students to develop a program of research. And by staying focused on their passions, I think that it's more likely that the longevity of the research will be sustainable and will drive their own happiness and joy that they get out of the research, which will also result in better research for humanity, right?
Right.
I think also we at our school and at many schools, we're really are surrounded by people that are just incredibly smart in so many different ways and bringing a lot of life experiences. And so I would encourage people to just surround themselves with people that are smarter than them in those various ways, and to, you know, really take the time to find out in what ways your expertise, your experience complements someone else in order that a collaboration can really yield some cutting edge and innovative research questions.
That's beautiful. I always surround myself with people smarter than me, including this hour.
Likewise.
Well, this has been a fabulous time with you. And our last question we ask everyone is, can you share one of the most valuable pieces of advice you've ever received on any topic?
Yes. My PhD mentor, Dr. Loretta Sweet-Jamott, told me that I need to take care of myself in order to take care of others. And as another Black woman nurse scientist, she was really helping me to understand that as an emerging scientist in an environment where I was likely going to be one of few, that there was going to be a lot asked of me. So she encouraged me to make sure that I was taking care of myself so that I can do all of the caretaking that I really wanted to do for others.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Alexander, and enriching our understanding of how communities navigate challenges and thrive. For our listeners, check out our website, nursing.jhu.edu/aging-fast-and-slow, for the articles and resources referenced in the episode. Have comments, questions, or guest suggestions? Reach out to us at agingfastandslow@jhu.edu.
And if you enjoyed this podcast, please share it with a friend, rate it, or write us a review. Special thanks to Jennifer McCord for editing and sound design, Rafe Reggie and Florentina Costaca for technical expertise, Brian Fitzek for production, and Tim Carl and Danielle Kress for web design. See you next time on Aging Fast and Slow.